Good morning, everybody, and welcome to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is the Wall Street Journal for August 14th, 2025, and I'm Steve Klein. Here's our first article, and it involves implications of the tariff program. The title of the article is, "The U.S. Alcohol Industry is Reeling from Canada's Booze Boycott." Canada's prohibition on U.S. alcohol is creating a headache for American liquor and winemakers. On the shelves of many Canadian liquor stores, bottles of Jack Daniel's, Maker's Mark, and Sailor Jerry Spiced Rum are nowhere to be found. Thousands of bottles of U.S. wine and spirits sit in storage across the country. At tastings, Canadian drinkers are turning up their noses at American alcohol. After President Trump initiated a series of trade battles with Canada earlier this year, Canadian provinces, which largely handle alcohol imports and distribution in the country, stopped placing orders for American-made spirits, beer, and wine. In liquor stores, clerks pulled U.S. brands off shelves, replacing them with Canadian products. Mike Brisbois, who runs a digital magazine called The Whiskey Explorer, held a tasting in June where he served only Canadian, Irish, and Scotch whiskies on the recommendation of his guests. The general theme was that they were boycotting the United States. In the roughly 6 months that have passed since the U.S.-Canada trade spat kicked off, the hit to the U.S. alcohol industry is coming into view. The Distilled Spirits Council, an industry group, estimated exports of U.S. distilled spirits to Canada at 43.4 million over the first 6 months of 2025, down about 62% from the same period in 2024. Exports of U.S. wine were about 67% lower, the group said, citing U.S. trade data. Ontario, Canada's most populous province, sells spirits and wines to residents through 688 stores, operated by the Liquor Control Board of Ontario. Last year, the LCBO sold more than $700 million worth of American liquor and wine, sales that have now dwindled to zero. Wine Institute, a trade group representing California-based wineries, estimated that in 6 months this year, U.S. wineries have lost more than $173 million in export value. In 2024, Canada comprised 35% of all U.S. wine export business, making it the industry's largest export destination by far. The absence of U.S. wine from Canadian stores is not just a market disruption. It's a breakdown in a trusted relationship built over decades, said Wine Institute Chief Executive Robert Koch. This is not just about wine. It's about farming families, rural jobs, and businesses that depend on access to international markets. At Paso Robles, California-based Hope Family Wines, sales to Canada have fallen by about 10% this year. Gretchen Roddick, an executive vice president at the winery, said bottles of its Cabernet Sauvignon and other products have been sitting in storage in Canada since being taken off shelves earlier this year. "It's definitely going to hurt us personally," she said. Robert Cullen, CEO of Baltimore-based Sagamore Spirit, said it can take around 3 years to get Canadian market approval for the rye whiskey made by the distillery on the city's waterfront. Until earlier this year, 10% of the company's exports had gone to Canada, but that number has now dropped to zero, Cullen said. Cullen estimates Sagamore will lose out on roughly $2 million of sales this year, equivalent to a container of rye comprising roughly 1,209 liter cases. We're a small craft distillery, so a couple of million dollars is pretty significant. Canadian liquor stores these days are heavily stocked with domestically produced brands like Maverick Distillery's Barn Burner Whiskey and Cavi Reserve Coffee Blended Canadian Whiskey. A spokesman for Ontario's finance department said that since the boycott on U.S. alcohol, sales of Canadian-made products have risen 14% in the province. Ontario removed the alcohol in the face of President Trump's tariffs, taking direct aim at our economy, he said. U.S. Ambassador to Canada, Pete Hoekstra, told a conference in Washington State last month that the U.S. booze boycott is one of the reasons Trump and the White House have called Canada mean and nasty to deal with. Some Canadian consumers still have a thirst for U.S.-made alcohol. After the province of Alberta halted purchases of American liquor in March, wholesale purchases of U.S. liquor dropped 40% for the 3 months between April and June, compared to the same period last year, according to a spokeswoman for the Alberta Gaming, Liquor, and Cannabis Commission. Sales of American wine fell about 55%. Alberta in June resumed U.S. alcohol purchases in a bid to improve the tone of Canada-U.S. trade talks, said Dale Nolly, the province's minister of red tape reduction. The American booze carries a 25% tariffs, but customers are still buying. Jamsine Gruel, who owns Platina Liquor in Calgary, Alberta's largest city, said U.S. wine sales have jumped 30% in recent weeks, while sales of U.S. bourbon have risen 7%. She said Canadians from other provinces are bulk buying U.S.-produced bread and butter Cabernet Sauvignon and wines from California-based Josh Sellers. People are scared that they maybe won't be able to get them again, Gruel said. If you're living in a blue state, this next article may affect you. It's about income taxes. Blue states hunt for ways to wring more taxes from the wealthy. Taylor Swift tax, among other levies, targets the rich. Will they be driven away? Here's the basic summary of the article. Several blue states and cities are considering a boost in taxes on the wealthy to offset existing budget deficits or potential federal funding shortfalls. A growing number of blue cities and states across the country, from Washington State to Rhode Island, are looking at ways to wring more revenue from their richest taxpayers. Lawmakers are boosting tax rates on robust annual incomes, hiking capital gains taxes, and putting new levies on luxury vacation homes. Some state legislatures have proposed higher taxes in response to projected shortfalls in federal funding related to President Trump's new tax law, which extends a broad federal tax cut to the wealthy. The law also makes deep cuts to funding for such programs as Medicaid, pressuring states to make up some or all of the shortfall. This is an attempt to acknowledge that people are being richly rewarded by the economy in its current form. There are people who are going to be disproportionately benefit from the bill passed by Congress, said Minnesota State Representative Aisha Gomez, a Democrat who sponsored legislation that would implement a higher tax rate for joint filers in Minnesota, making over $1 million a year if federal Medicaid cuts take effect. Other lawmakers are trying to address existing state budget deficits. Some legislatures who are considering potential taxes on rich residents of their states have been inspired by the billions of dollars Massachusetts has collected since it implemented an income surtax on those earning more than $1 million a year. Connecticut legislatures have proposed a bill that would raise income tax rates on couples making at least $500,000 and individuals making at least $250,000 to offset expected federal funding losses from the new federal tax law. Washington Governor Bob Ferguson, a Democrat, in May signed into law a budget that includes an increase in the capital gains tax, among other things, citing a need to address the state's budget deficit, as well as expected cuts to federal funding. Maryland Governor Wes Moore, a Democrat, in May signed into law his tax proposal, which includes higher income tax rates for state residents making more than $500,000 a year. This was done to close a budget deficit. Rhode Island in June imposed a new tax on certain vacation homes, valued at $1 million or more, as the state tries to address its budget deficit. The levy, known as the Taylor Swift tax, takes effect next summer. The pop star owns a home in the wealthy Watch Hill neighborhood of Westerly, Rhode Island. More tax-the-rich efforts might be coming. Many states face projected budget deficits after increasing spending and cutting taxes in the flush post-pandemic years, even before the GOP's tax law impacts are taken into account. Most of the 19 states that assess their budgets at least 3 years out are projecting deficits, said Josh Goodman, a senior officer at Pew Charitable Trusts, who focuses on states' fiscal health. He said states could also see their expenses rise if they opt to increase funding to programs such as food assistance and Medicaid to make up for federal budget cuts. States are grappling with how the new federal tax law flows through to their respective tax codes, said Aidan Davis of the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, a left-leaning tax policy nonprofit. She said some state legislatures were starting to ask the group for help in designing progressive tax policies, or policies that increase taxes on the wealthy to drum up additional revenue. Tax hikes on the rich have long raised fears among low-tax advocates that they'll prompt an exodus of the wealthy. Some wealthy people fled the UK after its recent decision to abolish a centuries-old tax loophole. Worries about tax flight have cropped up in New York City with the rise of Zoran Mondani, a self-described democratic socialist running for mayor. He proposed a 2% tax on New Yorkers earning more than $1 million a year. Academic research and state tax receipts suggest a cloudier relationship between tax policies and the propensity of the wealthy to move. Rich people who have school-age children, have working partners, or own a local business tend to be strongly anchored in place. But there are limits to that stickiness. Elite subgroups of the rich, such as older billionaires, are highly sensitive to certain taxes. Cristobal Young, a Cornell University sociologist, and Ithai Luri of the Treasury Department analyzed 3.9 million individual tax filings for top earners over 7 years for a coming paper in the American Journal of Sociology. They looked at the rate of movement before and after the 2017 federal tax law. That overhaul made it costlier to live in high-tax states such as New York and California, because of a new cap it put on deductions for state and local taxes, or SALT. They found that those with annual incomes of at least $1 million facing higher taxes were no more likely to move in the 2 years following the 2017 tax change than peers in lower tax states. Millionaires who were highly embedded in their communities, for example, those owning a local business or having children at home, were less likely to move in general. They also found that when millionaires did move, they tended to opt for lower tax states. Young said ties and the strength of those ties matter. Money should make mobility happen, but moving your home is not fun, he said. It's really costly in terms of uprooting yourself. Massachusetts voters in 2022 approved a 4% surtax on annual income over $1 million. Revenue from the millionaire's tax increased to nearly $3 billion during the 2025 fiscal year, according to the Massachusetts Revenue Department, up from $2.46 billion a year earlier. It is difficult to assess how the number of millionaire filers in Massachusetts has changed since the tax was passed, because of a lag in tax filer data from federal and state agencies. Plus, the stock market's climb might have created new millionaires in the state, but the earlier data from the state's revenue department shows enough high earners continue to reside in Massachusetts to exceed the state's forecast for revenue generated by the surtax. Billionaires, particularly older billionaires, appear to be more tax sensitive. A 2023 study looked at movement among billionaires listed in the Forbes 400 between 1981 and 2017. The period encompasses a 2001 federal tax change that created sharp differences in state-to-state taxes, or taxes assessed on the very wealthy on assets left at death. It found that after 2001, older billionaires were less likely to live in states with the state taxes compared with their younger peers. It also found that by 2010, 21.4% of the billionaires who had been living in an estate tax state had moved to a state without an estate tax, while 1.2% of those living in a non-estate tax state had moved to one with an estate tax. The location of the ultra-wealthy matters, given their potential impacts on state budgets, wrote Enrico Moretti, an economist at the University of California, Berkeley, and Daniel J. Wilson of the Federal Reserve Bank in San Francisco, in a billionaire's paper in American Economic Journal's Economic Policy. They estimated that the 2019 death of the billionaire David Koch could have resulted in New York State's receiving around $4.17 billion over several years. The Princeton University economist Henry Kleven is co-author of a 2025 National Bureau of Economics Research working paper on the wealthy in Denmark and Sweden. It found that for each percentage point increase in the top wealth tax, the tax on the total value of assets and not just on income, the population of wealthy residents in those countries decreased by about 2%. Yet it also found that wealth taxes more than made up for the revenue lost from the departing rich. The title of our next article is Stock Market Today: Dow Drops After Wholesale Inflation Accelerates. Factory gate prices rose by a much stronger than expected 0.9% in July. Stocks slipped after new data showed that factory gate inflation was picking up, introducing fresh question marks over coming interest rate cuts. The producer price index showed prices rose by a much stronger than expected 0.9% in July, the largest monthly increase in more than 3 years. A day earlier, futures markets suggested investors were highly confident in the Federal Reserve would cut rates in September after Tuesday's reassuring consumer price index. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent had talked up a larger 0.5 percentage point cut. But traders moved early Thursday to pair bets on a September cut slightly, CME Group data showed. San Francisco President Mary Daly, who favors lowering rates next month, pushed back Wednesday against the need for a jumbo cut. "I'm worried it would send off an urgency signal that I don't feel about the strength of the labor market," she said. Chicago Fed Austin Goolsbee also signaled caution late Wednesday, flagging a jump in some service prices in the CPI report, and saying the labor market remained solid. In tariff news, U.S. negotiators sent the European Union their outline of a long-awaited trade agreement, building on a handshake deal the bloc's leader struck with President Trump last month. In recent trading, the Dow Industrials slipped while the S&P 500 and NASDAQ Composite were muted. On Wednesday, the S&P and the NASDAQ closed at record highs for a second straight session. Treasury yields advanced. 10-year yields, a key indicator of your borrowing costs, rose toward 4.27%. The dollar weakened against the Japanese yen, after Bessent said the Bank of Japan was falling behind in tackling inflation. Global stocks were mixed. European defense stocks rose ahead of Friday's meeting between President Trump and Russian leader Vladimir Putin. Japanese and Chinese benchmarks fell. Now, we mentioned earlier that wholesale inflation was up during the month of July. Here's an article by Matt Grossman. What drove up wholesale inflation last month? A 0.9% monthly increase in factory gate prices in July was an ugly surprise to economists who were expecting a 0.2% rise, here are some of the categories that rose the most. Food prices charged by producers, which can be volatile, increased substantially. After declines earlier this year, egg prices advanced 7.3% last month. Beef and veal were up 4.6%. Overall, wholesale food prices increased 1.4%. Wholesale electronics got more expensive, too. Prices on TVs and video equipment rose 3.8%. Wholesale computer hardware and software added 3.5%. Prices charged by the financial industry also increased. Portfolio management services grew 5.8% more expensive last month. Brokerage services were up 3.2%. So, what's going on around the globe, and how does it affect supply and demand? Title of the article is Hapag-Lloyd Narrows Guidance Despite Heightened Uncertainty from Global Tensions. Continuing Red Sea tensions and global trade conflict could have a significant impact on supply and demand. The article is by Dominic Chapping. Here's a quick summary. Hapag-Lloyd narrowed its full-year earnings guidance, but warned that demand in the rest of the year could slow down. Shipping giant Hapag-Lloyd narrowed its full-year earnings guidance range, but warned that demand in the rest of the year could slow, sending shares sharply lower. Continuing Red Sea tensions and global trade conflicts could have a significant impact on supply and demand in container shipping. The German company said higher permanent tariffs and a previous spike in demand as customers shipped goods ahead of the proposed levies could mean that demand now eases. Shares were down 11% in early European trading. Comments that front-loading and higher permanent tariffs might slow down demand in the second half of 2025 are at slight odds with the more optimistic outlook that Maersk communicated last week, analysts at J.P. Morgan said in a note to clients. President Trump's tariff regime and increasing macroeconomic uncertainty have clouded the outlook for global trade and disrupted supply chains. For container shipping, that meant a sharp drop in cargo being transported from China to the United States after Trump slapped tariffs totaling 145% on imported Chinese goods in April. An interim agreement was reached at the beginning of May that sent freight rates sharply higher as demand spiked before normalizing again, leading freight rates to fall. U.S. trade agreements have also recently been reached with major exporters such as Japan and the European Union, with a 15% baseline tariff agreed upon for both countries. The tariff uncertainty has resulted in a subdued peak season so far, and while the recent tariff agreements should provide more planning clarity for shippers, the finalization of deals is still pending, and additional sectoral tariffs are looming. The new tariffs will probably constrain short-term volume growth on U.S.-bound routes, Hapag-Lloyd said. In the Middle East, container operators continued to divert their ships on longer routes to avoid hostilities in the Red Sea, and Hapag-Lloyd said it remains unclear when passage through the key commercial strait will be safe again. The latest attacks on vessels by the Houthi militia make a swift return to the Red Sea currently unlikely, it said. The world's fifth largest container line by capacity said it would stay focused on growth and quality as well as operational and commercial performance in the second half of the year while continuing to optimize its cost structure. Efficiencies from a cost-saving program and its new network sharing agreement with A.P. Moller Maersk are expected to save more than $1 billion in 2026. At the same time, we'll do everything in our power to help our customers navigate this volatile market environment, and we hope that more new trade agreements will make their supply chains more predictable, Chief Executive Rolf Habben Jansen said. It now expects to report full-year earnings before interest, tax, depreciation, and amortization between 2.5 billion and 3.4 billion euros. That is 2.93 billion to 3.98 billion in US dollars, compared with its previous expectation of between 2.4 billion and 3.9 billion euros. Earnings before interest and tax is forecast at 200 million to 1.1 billion euros from previous guidance of up to 1.5 billion euros. Given the weak demand backdrop and macro uncertainty, we would expect consensus to move towards the lower end of the guidance range, JP Morgan analysts said. The company's second quarter revenue climbed to 4.63 billion euros from 4.54 billion euros a year earlier, while EBITDA fell 25% to 711 million euros. A fact set of poll analysts had expected a range of 4.38 billion euros at EBITDA and 7.27 billion euros. And now for an article on U.S. steel, and this is not good news. The title of the article is U.S. Steel Explosion Presents Challenge to Nippon's Investment Plans. Crews work to restore operations after the deaths of two employees. The article is by Bob Tita and Chris Mayer. Here's a quick summary. A deadly explosion at U.S. Steel's Clairton plant is testing the resolve of Nippon Steel. Nippon Steel promised to spend $14 billion to keep U.S. Steel's aging plants humming for decades. A deadly blast at a mill near Pittsburgh will test the Japanese steelmaker's resolve through a costly crisis. Crews are continuing to clean up and restore operations at Clairton, Pennsylvania, where an explosion Monday killed two workers and injured 10 others. U.S. Steel officials said the blast reduced the company's ability to produce coke, a key steelmaking input, at its Mon Valley Works complex. Jim Prokowski, an employee with 21 years of service, was among those transporting injured workers from the wreckage. "It was chaos. We ran to help whoever and to do whatever we could," he said. Mon Valley was a focal point of Nippon Steel's negotiations with President Trump. 2 months ago, he approved the purchase of U.S. Steel after the Tokyo-based company significantly increased its investment commitments. Nippon Steel pledged $2.2 billion for upgrades at Mon Valley by 2028, projects that would maintain steelmaking at the mill for years. The to-do list didn't include major repairs to Clairton's coke ovens. It will likely cost the company millions of dollars to return the site to normal operations. The Clairton coking plant, the nation's largest, has dealt with operational concerns in the past. An explosion at the plant in 2010 injured 20 workers. A catastrophic fire on Christmas Eve 2018 knocked out the plant's emissions for control systems for months afterwards. In February, two employees were sent to the hospital when gases ignited at a coke plant battery, which Allegheny County officials said caused an audible boom and surge in airborne pollutants. Nippon Steel said work on the planned replacement of the rolling line to make sheet steel would continue, but added, "Our primary focus remains on our employees at the Clairton plant." U.S. Steel Chief Executive Dave Barritt said Tuesday that he spoke with Nippon Steel executives following the accident and said they're committed to cooperating with government investigators to determine the cause for the explosion. "We'll take every step necessary to keep our people safe," Barritt said during a briefing with reporters. "We wouldn't have done the deal with Nippon Steel if we weren't absolutely sure that we'd have an enduring future." U.S. Steel deferred some maintenance and upgrade projects for years in response to a long stretch of financial losses before 2020. In the months before the deal closed, Nippon Steel Vice Chairman Takahiro Mori visited the Mon Valley complex several times to confirm the company's interest in preserving American jobs and investing in the mill. The steelmaker later dispatched teams of engineers and other employees from Japan to begin work on the plant upgrades. The cause of the explosion remains under investigation. Just before the blast, workers were preparing to do routine maintenance on the batteries of ovens that bake coal into coke. Coke is essential for producing molten iron at U.S. Steel's blast furnaces in Pennsylvania and Indiana. As part of the coking process, flammable compounds such as methane and other impurities are extracted from the coal under heat and pressure, leaving a carbon product behind. The Clairton plant can produce 3.6 million tons of coke across its six batteries of ovens. The explosion knocked out two batteries, and two more near the blast area were temporarily taken down for repairs. Emissions from coke plants have been a target for environmental groups for years, especially in Pittsburgh, which has been a hub of steel production for over a century. U.S. Steel last year settled a lawsuit brought by environmental groups over emissions that stemmed from the 2018 Clairton plant fire. The settlement with the groups and the county included $19.5 million in coke oven upgrades and $17.5 million in other plant improvements. The company has said it regretted the incidents and believed the settlement would benefit communities near the mill. Experts in the litigation provided descriptions of the Clairton plant's condition. In court filings, an engineering expert for environmental groups described plant inspections as sporadic and said that repairs were delayed by budget constraints. The expert cited an internal company email that mentioned examples of corrosion that included water supply lines that were rotted coke can thin. A county health department official described the plant in a 2020 deposition as one of the most decrepit facilities I've ever seen in my nearly 30 years of work. Borkowski, 40, who works as a union safety representative, said he thinks the company stays on top of maintenance for the most part, but acknowledged that the company needs promised investments from Nippon Steel. "It's an aging plant," said Borkowski, a third-generation steel worker. "I just hope they stick to their word, and I hope they invest the money in Mon Valley." Here's a stock market article, and the title of the article is, "The Entire Stock Market is Being Carried by These Four AI Stocks." NVIDIA and three other big tech names have been responsible for 60% of stock market gains this year. Still, the rally could keep going on. The article is by Christine G. For investors today, it feels like there's no alternative to buying tech stocks. After all, the S&P 500's rebound from its Liberation Day low was mostly thanks to massive run-up of just four big tech names as artificial intelligence enthusiasm again gripped markets. NVIDIA alone accounts for 26% of the S&P 500's year-to-date advance. If there'd been no Gen AI buzz this year, the S&P 500 would likely be up 3-4% instead of 10%. Nicholas Kolis, co-founder of DataTrek Research, wrote, "The AI hype has lifted the S&P 500 to a pricey valuation. The index trades at price-to-earning ratios of 22 times, and DataTrek calculates the S&P 500's AI premium provides a 2.7-point or 14.2% boost to the index's valuation. That means the S&P 500 would trade at just 19.4 times earnings without the AI premium. And it's not just the U.S. stock market that's being taken over by big tech. The weighings of the so-called Magnificent Seven in aggregate make up over 20% of the MSCI All Country Index. NVIDIA, Microsoft, and Apple are each weighted more heavily than China's 3%. The stock market bifurcation between tech and non-tech has become increasingly apparent with this development, presenting new challenges for investors looking for diversification. While tariff concerns earlier this year led to some investors questioning whether American exceptionalism was a thing of the past, as far as the stock market goes, The sustained performance of these companies show that big tech names from U.S. dominate markets everywhere. Even when considering global rather than just U.S. large cap portfolio allocations, the only call that really matters is to be over or underweight U.S. tech, Colas wrote. Everything else, from developed emergency markets to country weightings, is a second or third order concern. For now, Colas thinks there's still more room for these tech stocks to run, he said, as these companies have posted strong earnings and have solid business models. He's leaning into the big tech trade, he said, and believes the company's earnings momentum will carry the stock market to new highs by year end. However, such heightened market concentration leaves the S&P 500 susceptible to big pullbacks should the AI trade falter. According to Colas, if the Gen AI trade hits a pothole, the index could lose somewhere between 6 to 14%, or perhaps even more if investor sentiment suddenly changes toward the negative. Our next article is an AI article, and I must admit it's hard to avoid AI articles. This one is titled, What Musk, Altman, and Others Say About AI-Funded Universal Basic Income. Silicon Valley's latest buzzword envisions a future in which AI generates a surge of new wealth shared among the masses. The article is by Josie Reich. AI is making even more jobs obsolete. The solution from Silicon Valley? A universal paycheck, no work required. Technology titans including Elon Musk and Sam Altman see a future flush with wealth generated by artificial intelligence. Some tech heavyweights have endorsed no-strings cash distributions for a decade, a so-called universal basic income, or UBI. While many think of UBI as a taxpayer-funded system, Silicon Valley's elite envision AI doing humans' work, from mundane factory jobs to highly skilled white-collar roles, and funding payouts through cost savings and more revenue. Tech leaders say that revenue can be shared under a massive wealth redistribution system. Suddenly, an idea once seen as a socialist policy that would reward idleness is one of the AI boom's hottest acronyms. Okay, what is UBI? Economists and welfare rights activists began advocating for UBI in the 1960s as a solution for poverty. As mainframe computers popped up in offices that same decade and sparked job loss fears, proponents wondered if UBI could be the solution to technology displacing humans, said Carl Weiderquist, a philosophy professor at Georgetown University in Qatar. Twitter co-founder Jack Dorsey and Facebook co-founder Chris Hughes have spent millions over the past several years on pilot projects. Some current UBI trial programs aim to reduce poverty or respond to explosive automations, sharing donor and grant money with individuals and families. Sam Altman, CEO of OpenAI, funded an experiment starting in 2016 that gave $1,000 in cash to a group of low-income individuals each month for 3 years. Recipients worked slightly less and mostly spent on basic necessities, said Elizabeth Rhodes, who ran the open research study. Altman said in an appearance on Theo Von's This Past Weekend podcast in July that he now thinks that instead of money, everyone could receive an ownership share in whatever the AI creates. That would allow the wealth accumulated by AI to be spread across the population, he said, calling the idea universal extreme wealth. He imagined a scenario in which every human is given a trillion tokens, the basic unit of information that large language models use. Each year they receive these tokens to sell or treat as personal wealth, an alternative to all wealth being consolidated in the normal capitalistic system. Elon Musk, CEO of Tesla, touts universal high income, the concept that AI will automate most production and the public can share in the revenue. Musk said at a forum in May that universal income could create a Star Trek future with a level of prosperity and hopefully happiness that we can't quite imagine today. He also warned that if handled incorrectly, we could end up with the Terminator future. Mark Benioff, CEO of Salesforce, has said that up to half of the work at the company is now done by AI. He's an evangelist for universal basic income and said during the pandemic that he sees COVID-19 stimulus checks as a model for broader income distribution. He wrote that automation will drive income inequality and necessitate supplemental income for those who can't be retrained, and even those who traditionally are not compensated for raising a family or volunteering to help others, in a Fortune article. He said that AI will generate wealth by lowering costs in companies. Not all of Silicon Valley, or the public writ large, is on board. Critics think universal income is politically unrealistic and allows tech companies to justify increasing unemployment and wealth disparities. David Autor, a labor economist at MIT, said the hypothetical society in which the majority of income is distributed from a few sources is frightening and a political fantasy land. AI leaders support universal income because they think they're going to put everyone out of work and they don't have a better idea for what to do about that, he said. He wondered what would happen to people outside of the U.S. who could lose their work without receiving universal income. Venture capitalist Marc Andreessen argued in his 2023 Techno-Optimist Manifesto that humans need to work to feel fulfilled. Man was meant to be useful, to be productive, to be proud, he wrote. Andreessen thinks AI will transform almost every job, he wrote on Substack, that UBI is unnecessary because the government is likely to subsidize most industries. David Sachs, President Trump's AI czar, said on his All In podcast last year that tech magnates seeking fortune from the AI boom use the idea of handing out money to assuage concern about jobs losses, but that doing so doesn't serve society. He posted on X in June that universal income is a fantasy of welfare that is simply not going to happen. Here is yet another article on the implication of the new tariff program. Title of the article is Chinese Imports Fell During Trump's First Term. It's happening again. As other Asian companies ramp up manufacturing, the U.S. snaps up fewer Chinese goods. The article is by Cao Deng and Peter Santilli. President Trump recently delayed for 90 days raising tariffs on China to give the two sides more time to negotiate a trade deal. Where the sides ultimately end up is an open question. The president hasn't said how much more he will impose on China beyond the 30% currently in place if a deal isn't reached. But this much is clear. The U.S.'s reliance on Chinese goods has fallen off since Trump first put tariffs on China in 2018. China now accounts for only about 12% of all U.S. imports, down from a peak of 22% in 2018. According to a 12-month rolling data from the U.S. Census, the U.S. deficit with China, which Trump has often railed against, has shrunk to about $280 billion based on 12-month rolling data. The peak was $418 billion in December of 2018. During Trump's first term, U.S. imports of Chinese goods declined soon after tariffs were imposed and bottomed out during the pandemic. Earlier this year, at the start of his second term, many American companies loaded up on imports before most tariffs took effect, then stepped on the brakes this spring after the bulk of levies hit. Tariffs have prompted other American businesses to cancel orders from China. Goods that once came from China are also being made in other Asian countries, including Vietnam, Indonesia, and India. In recent years, these countries have rushed to build up their manufacturing capacities. The statistic might understate the true level of Chinese imports, although it's difficult to gauge by how much. Some products that get labeled as coming from Vietnam or elsewhere actually originate in China and are largely made there. The manufacturers have no legitimate reason to ship them through Vietnam, aside from trying to dodge tariffs. In an effort to crack down on so-called trans-shipping, the U.S. is charging 40% on goods from other countries that pass through Vietnam on their way to the United States. That compares with the 20% duties that the U.S. is charging on Vietnamese goods in general. It will be a game of enforcement, says Mary Lovely of the Peterson Institute for International Economics. How well customs authorities can catch transshipped items, as well as exactly what they consider a transshipment, are yet to be seen. Most key categories of Chinese imports have fallen, including smartphones, toys, and furniture. One counterexample, imports of batteries for use in consumer electronics and electric vehicles. They've soared in the past year due to China's continued hold on the industry's supply chain and strong U.S. demand. Former President Joe Biden largely kept Trump's first-term tariffs in place while rolling out some of his own. Earlier this year, Trump added 10% on all Chinese imports, citing the country's alleged role in illicit fentanyl trading. He added another 10% for the same reason. A third layer of 125% duties brought the total imposed on China this year to 145%. The beginning of trade talks between the two countries in May then brought it down to 30%, where it still sits. Even higher tariffs could encourage more companies to move out of China, further lowering Chinese imports to the U.S. But the process becomes harder for higher-value manufacturing like machinery and electronics. Now, we've mentioned transshipping. Here's an article dealing specifically with transshipping through Vietnam. The article's by Jason Douglas and John Emont, and it's titled, Vietnam Trade Deal Takes Aim at Backdoor for Chinese Goods. The deal with Vietnam seeks to stop Chinese-made goods from transiting through the Southeast Asian country to avoid higher duties. A tariff agreement with Vietnam emphasizes one of the White House's top priorities in this frantic round of deal-making over global trade, slamming shut any backdoor routes for Chinese goods to enter the United States. A key provision of the Vietnam deal, announced by President Trump Wednesday, is that goods transshipped to the United States through Vietnam would be subject to a punitive 40% tariff, twice the 20% rate that Trump said he's applying to regular imports from Vietnam. The president didn't mention China explicitly, and the exact details about how such rerouting will be defined and policed are unclear. Nevertheless, analysts say the measure appears squarely aimed at making it harder for firms to use the Southeast Asian nation as a staging post to ship goods to the U.S. from China while sidestepping the steep levies that Chinese imports would typically face. These provisions from Vietnam deal show that China remains the central focus of U.S. trade policy, even after Washington and Beijing reached a shaky trade truce and discussions with other partners over trade drag on. The agreement implies that other countries will also be expected to limit China's presence in their economies if they want to keep selling to the U.S. The U.S. and U.K. agreed to provisions in their recent trade pact that require the U.K. to strengthen supply chain security, which was similarly interpreted as targeting China. The U.S. plans to levy a tariff for 40% on goods shipped to the U.S. from China through Vietnam. There does appear to be a more strategic intent here by the United States to essentially restrict Chinese imports entering the U.S. market via the back door, said Frederick Newman, chief Asia economist at HSBC in Hong Kong. Chinese Foreign Minister spokeswoman Mao Ning on Thursday reiterated Beijing's displeasure at the U.S. approach when asked about the PAC, saying trade negotiations and agreements should not target or harm the interest of third parties. The Vietnamese government said that it welcomed the agreement. Vietnam was one of the main beneficiaries of the reordering of global supply chains in the wake of Trump's first term and the tumult of the COVID-19 pandemic. Factories mushroomed around Hanoi and Ho Chi Minh City as Chinese and Western firms looked for ways to diversify their production base amid the strains of the pandemic and increasing geopolitical rivalry between Washington and Beijing. For U.S. consumers, Vietnam's entry into the top rank of exporting nations brought a bounty of affordable goods as companies like Nike and Apple expanded production in the country. Shares of both companies rose Thursday after Trump announced the trade pact. Michael Bursch, who runs a factory in Vietnam that sells baby furniture, such as cribs, to the United States and other Western countries, said the 20% tariffs will inevitably translate into higher prices for American consumers. Still, he said he thought that Vietnam would remain a top destination for manufacturing. U.S. imports for China are subject to an average tariff of 40 to 50%, giving Vietnam an edge even with the 20% tariff. But whether it can keep that advantage depends on where tariff rates settle for alternative bases such as India and Indonesia. We need to wait and see what tariffs will be imposed on other countries, but we don't think that will lose competitiveness, Bursch said. As recently as 2018, the U.S. deficit in goods trade with Vietnam was smaller than its deficit with Japan or Germany, and a tenth the size of its deficit with China. By the end of the year, the U.S. deficit with Vietnam had ballooned to more than $120 billion, putting Vietnam behind only China and Mexico in its share of the U.S.'s $1.2 trillion goods trade deficit. Vietnam's rise up the rankings in U.S. trade has also drawn scrutiny from the U.S. as a hub for simply rerouting China-made goods bound for the U.S. for firms wanting to dodge tariffs. Chinese exports to the U.S. were about 10% lower in the first 5 months of the year than the same period a year earlier, as tariffs bit into direct trade between the two economic superpowers. Over the same period, however, Vietnamese imports from China were up 28% year over year, Vietnamese data shows, while Vietnamese exports to the U.S. rose 26%. Dipali Bhargava, regional head of research for Asia-Pacific at investment bank ING, said in a report Thursday, there are strong signs of transshipment in sectors including machinery, electrical parts, and insulated wires and cables. Vietnam has taken steps to crack down on such trade rerouting through tougher policing of rules of origin certification, which give customs authorities detailed information about where a product and its components were made to levy the appropriate duties. Many different kinds of goods made in Vietnam, including clothing, furniture, and electronics, use components made in China. Exactly how the U.S. plans to determine whether a product from Vietnam would qualify for a 20% tariff or a 40% tariff isn't clear. Still, these provisions send a clear message to global firms. The recent fall in tariffs between the U.S. and China doesn't weaken the argument for building supply chains outside China, Capital Economics economist Mark Williams and Gareth Leather said in a report on Thursday. Our last article of the day deals with the Bureau of Labor Statistics. The title of the article is "The Partisan Economist Trump Wants to Oversee the Nation's Data." The article's by Paul Kiernan. E.J. Antoni lacks the research record of previous commissioners of the Bureau of Labor Statistics, but has a solid record of backing Trump's narrative of the economy. Conservative economist Irwin John E.J. Antoni sometimes jokes on social media that the L in the Bureau of Labor Statistics acronym is silent. President Trump this week tapped Antoni to run the agency, whose data and methodologies he's long criticized, especially when it produces numbers that Trump doesn't like. He recently proposed suspending the monthly jobs report, one of the most important data releases for the economy and markets. On Tuesday, a White House official noted that Antoni made the comment before he knew he was going to be chosen, and that his comments don't reflect official BLS policy. If confirmed by the Senate, Antoni would run a 141-year-old agency staffed by around 2,000 economists, statisticians, and other officials. The BLS has a long record of independence and nonpartisanship that economists and investors say is critical to the credibility of U.S. economic data. According to a commencement program from Northern Illinois University, Antoni earned a master's and Ph.D. in economics from that school in 2018 and 2020, respectively, and a Bachelor of Arts degree from St. Charles Borromeo Seminary. Antoni's LinkedIn profile that he said he attended Lansdale Catholic High School outside Philadelphia from 2002 and 2006. Past BLS commissioners have had extensive research experience, and many have climbed the ranks of the agency itself. Antoni doesn't fit that profile. He doesn't appear to have published any formal academic research since his dissertation, according to the queries of National Bureau of Economic Research, Working Papers, and Google Scholar. Much of his commentary on the Heritage website praises Trump's policies and economic record. He frequently posts on X and appears on conservative podcasts, such as former Trump advisor Steve Bannon's War Room, where he criticized the economy under President Joe Biden and lauds Trump's economy. Folks, that's all we have time for. Thank you very much for listening. This is Sun Sounds of Arizona. The program is The Wall Street Journal, and I'm Steve Klein.